This is Talk is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Okay, today I've got an interview I did with the bass player from Gong. They are playing at the Wow Hall on June 16th. It should be a great show if you're into psychedelic rock. But first, there's a boycott on windmill mushrooms from Sunnyside, Washington. Boycott any mushrooms that are from Sunnyside, Washington. And, of course, the No Kings event is coming up on June 14th. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. No Kings mass protest, June 14th, 2025. No Kings, rise up for justice, Eugene, Oregon. Saturday, June 14th, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, at 405 East Avenue, Eugene, Oregon, 97401. In America, we don't put up with would-be kings. No Kings is a national day of action and mass mobilization in response to increasing authoritarian excesses and corruption from Trump and his allies. We've watched as they've cracked down on free speech, detained people for their political views, threatened to deport American citizens, and defied the courts. They've done this all while continuing to serve and enrich their billionaire allies. On Saturday, June 14th, we're taking to the streets nationwide. We're not gathering to feed his ego. We're building a movement that leaves him behind. The flag doesn't belong to Donald Trump. It belongs to us. We're not watching history happen. We're making it. On June 14th, we're showing up everywhere he isn't to say no to thrones, no to crowns, no to kings. Check out nokings.org for more information. A core principle behind all No Kings events is a commitment to nonviolent action. We expect all participants to seek to de-escalate any potential confrontation with those who disagree with our values. This event meets ADA standards. This is an outdoor event located on the sidewalks and plaza at the Wayne Lyman Morris United States Courthouse. That's the No Kings Rise Up for Justice, Eugene, Oregon, Saturday, June 14th, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., 405 East Avenue, Eugene, Oregon. For more information, go to nokings.org. That's nokings.org. United Farm Workers has launched its first boycott campaign since 2005, calling on consumers to avoid Windmill Mushroom Farm. The boycott was announced in December after Windmill and former owner Ostrom refused to recognize the union, retaliated against pro-union workers, and violated terms of a federal program that allows farms to bring in temporary foreign workers. Workers at the farm have been organizing since 2020. In 2023, Ostrom agreed to pay $3.4 million to resolve a lawsuit filed by the Washington State Attorney General the prior year. Ostrom had fired female and Washington-based workers and replaced them with male foreign workers hired through the H-2A visa program for temporary agricultural workers in violation of anti-discrimination laws. While the lawsuit was pending, Ostrom sold the mushroom farm to Windmill. Like Ostrom, Windmill has refused to recognize the Farm Workers Union. UFW President Teresa Romero said in a press release that the boycott would continue until the company agrees to recognize the union. Since Windmill took over, dozens of pro-union workers have been fired, UFW spokesperson Antonio De Loria Brust told the Labor Press. UFW believes the farm currently employs around 150 workers. The National Labor Relations Act, the federal law that protects private sector workers' rights to organize and requires employers to bargain, specifically excludes agricultural workers. Oregon, Washington, and a dozen other states allow collective bargaining for agricultural workers, but don't require employers to bargain with the union or face legal consequences for retaliating against pro-union workers. Windmill Farms mushrooms are sold under the Windmill label in grocery stores around the Pacific Northwest. The farm also grows mushrooms that are sold under store labels, so they don't show the Windmill Farms label. But UFW said Windmill is the only mushroom plant in the Sunnyside, Washington area, so consumers should avoid purchasing any mushrooms labeled as being produced in Sunnyside. So you guys are known as the Oddball Collective of Rock. So you want to tell me about Gong?
Well, I guess David was always an oddball, I think. He was kind of... you know, an original beatnik, beat poet. He was always wanting to be outside of the norm. He was into the whole kind of jazz scene. He was a big fan of Charles Mingus and all that kind of stuff.
I see in his bio that he demonstrated in Paris in the 60s.
Yeah, he was living in Paris. That's where he met Julie. She was teaching at the Sorbonne. She was she's a very clever woman. But they're also very unusual. She was living on a canal boat, which is where, so they got together and arranged happenings around Paris for a while until, the kind of riots in Paris, they kind of got out of Paris at that point and moved to Daea in Greece for a while. And then managed to get back into Paris later on, which is when they started going in about 1969, I think it was. The original lineup being David and Jilly and then the other French musicians. So they were kind of an experimental quartet. Yeah, and then David was asked to do an album. When he kind of put together Magic Brother, which was his kind of a proto gong. So he played a lot of the instruments on that album, and it's got a real spirit. I don't know if you've heard that album, but it's really it captures a lot of what David continued throughout the years, really. It's very melodic and very kind of crazy, but really well put together, surprisingly. It still sounds surprisingly good.
And so what you're doing now harkens back to that era.
In a way, well, the next album, the proper, you know, the kind of, that was released as Gong, that became the crucial one was Camembert Électrique, and yeah, we do hark back to that in spirit quite a lot, actually. And we still play one of the tracks from the album as an encore sometimes. Yeah, that's I think that's where it really kind of began to be properly focused as a band, in Camembert Électrique. And Didier Malherbe was involved at that point as well, so he was the sax player, he met them in Daea, and he brought so much to the sound of Gong, which does retain into the modern era, because Gong's always had a sax player, mostly Didier for most of the time, but Theo Travis did it for a while, who's well known in the prog world and the jazz scene, and Ian East has been in the band almost as long as I have, so he's a crucial part of the sound of the band.
And I hear a little of the Pierre Morland stuff in there with the saxophone, but mostly the Pixies era.
Well, not really. The Pierre Merlin was era was a, it kind of went off on a tangent into an area that certainly David Allen would never have been, you know, if he'd been in the band, it wouldn't have gone along that route.
Right.
There was always a bit of a tension in the band, because David always wanted it to become more anarchic and more experimental, I suppose. Whereas I think he got frustrated with some of the musicians in Gong in the Virgin era, because they were all getting into Weather Report and jazz fusion and stuff, and that was so alien to David. He wasn't interested in that at all, which in the end was why he left in whenever that was, 74 or something.
I hear a little bit of jazz fusion in there, especially the songs without any lyrics.
That's interesting that you say that. What albums have you listened to?
To be honest with you, I've been waiting for you guys for so long now. I bought it a couple years ago, and I just got it out the other day. It's the one with the triangle on it.
Unending Ascending.
Yeah, Unending Ascending.
Oh, okay, right. That's interesting you say that. I've never considered it as a jazz fusion band in the slightest.
Well, what would you call it then?
The sax brings a jazz element to it. Oh God! I mean, Gong's never been a particular. I don't think it's ever been in a particular genre. It's always had psychedelic leanings from the lyrics and the sort of what would you call it? Soundscape, mystical kind of aspect to the whole thing.
And that kind of gave other musicians the permission to do that, right? What was Gong's impact on the rest of the music world?
Yes, yeah, Gong's had a massive impact on so many people. It seems like it's given other musicians not that they need permission, but in a way, it gives a legitimacy to experimenting and going out there on a limb. Although it's not necessarily the best way to have a successful music career, because Gong could never be pigeonholed. It's never had a hit single or anything, so it's always been a kind of cult band. It's never been it never crossed over in any sense into the mainstream. I think David was probably happy about that, because he hated the idea of. He did everything he could to try and avoid success, I think.
Well, because who's showing up to your shows? Are you getting Zappa fans and Fish fans?
Yeah, well, I think anyone who's kind of into something that's just different to everything else that's going on. I mean, I think there is a big psychedelic element to what we do, and I think there's a big... seems to be a big upsurge in interest in psychedelic music of every kind of type that's out there. And yeah, increasingly we're getting younger audiences, and you know traditionally it's been middle-aged men. Since I mean, I joined in 2009, it's like 16 years ago now, and there's always been a preponderance of middle-aged men, I suppose, as being the main part of the audience. But increasingly, over the last 4 years, we've been getting much younger audiences and more women coming to gigs, which is very encouraging, really.
Well, because you can dance to it, right?
It astounds me that people can dance to it, because, we play in very strange time signatures very often. And it always amazes me that... And it's always the women who start dancing first, of course, and they get it. It's really fantastic. It makes a big difference to us when the audience are moving. As probably to every band, I guess.
And so you just released a new album, right?
Yeah, Unending. We're still promoting the Unending Ascending. We just released a special edition of that album, which has 6 live tracks on it as well, which is probably our most this version of Gong. It's our most successful album. It's really getting out to people in a way that we always hoped it would. It's and we're kind of. It's it's kind of the second album of a trilogy, really. It feels like the previous album, The Universe Also Collapses, kind of showed the way, really. That was the album that where we kind of really found our vision, I suppose, and then Unending Ascending's carrying on in that vein. And the next album that we're now working on will also be similar in concept. It's been a really interesting journey, actually, the way this has all progressed from when David... Because the other thing that's just come out now is the 10th anniversary edition of ICU, which was
the album that we did, this version of the band did with David Allen. So it was his final album before he died. And we've just had it totally remixed and slightly reworked, because there was issues with the original release that we've now fixed, and that is actually selling surprisingly well. It's only just come out in the last month, and it's a really interesting album to listen to again. I haven't listened to it for years, but you can sort of see what the musicians are, what we brought to the music, because that was the first album that we were involved in, and yet our combination with the way David works was really good. It's a shame that it was his last album, because we could have done it could have been an interesting journey if he'd managed to survive a bit longer.
That's too bad.
But anyway, he left it to us. He kind of said, when he knew that he wasn't going to be able to come back, he was fighting cancer, and he kind of stopped taking the treatment, I think, at that point. And he wrote us a letter that said that, he was handing it on to us, and he wanted us to carry on with it and take Gong into new unknown heights and depths far beyond anything he could ever imagine. So that kind of gave us free rein to do what we do, the five of us together. And it seems to be working out.
So we've been waiting for years for you to come to America. How did you find America, as they asked the Beatles?
I guess Gong was never particularly big in America. I don't think. I think Steve Village, when he left and had his solo career, he was probably a bit more successful than Gong were as a band. But so there's not been many visits from Gong over the years. And when Gong has been over there, it's been a financial disaster. So we came over in last September, October, to tour the sort of East Coast, Midwest kind of area. And it was really, really great. I was really surprised how enthusiastic the audiences were. It was really an unbelievably positive experience. So many, because we always, at the end of the gig, we always go to the merchandise desk and, sign whatever people want. And so we were there for like an hour or more, like 2 hours sometimes, just talking to people and signing stuff. And the enthusiasm was just really encouraging. It was really great to see. And also, and it worked out that for us, it was a financial success. It worked out great. So it's really good for us to now at least try. Hitting up the West Coast is going to be an interesting experience. Obviously, it's not so easy to tour on the West Coast, because it's such massive distances.
So I noticed you're not charging $300 for a show, and you're still selling CDs and downloads and stuff like that. Anything about the business model of the music industry and what you're doing differently? a lot of bands are just charging for the show and supporting themselves that way.
No, I don't think we have a method, really. We kind of just try and do whatever we can. You know, we're experienced with touring, obviously, around the UK and Europe and South America and Japan and everywhere, really. And we have a method that kind of works. I mean, the US is a different, it seems different to everywhere else. And I don't know if we've really taken on board the best way of doing it yet. But, so we have a system that works in most of the rest of the world. And I don't quite know whether what we're doing in the US is what's usual or not. You mentioned something called the Discipline Global Mobile. I don't know what that means, but...
That's kind of Robert Fripp's kind of management scheme to cut out corporate music industry and pay the musicians for their art better.
We run Gong. You know, we manage it as a band. We don't have a manager. We have agents who get us the gigs and things. So we kind of keep our costs as low as possible. And we also keep ticket prices as low as possible, really, because we don't want to, you know, we want people to come to the gigs and enjoy what we do, you know. So we kind of, we keep our costs low and we make just about enough money to make it all work.
I remember Steve Hillage started a commune, one of the few bands that had a commune around their music. Are you guys having a shared living space and studio that you all live at in a collective?
No, we all live in separate places and in separate countries, actually. It was David and Alan who set up the commune in France. Steve Hillage wasn't part of the band then. He wasn't one of the original members. He joined about 3 years later. But he was in the commune. They lived in a big house in France. And then when they got the deal with Virgin Records, they moved to the UK and tried to have the same vibe in a house in the countryside in the UK, but it didn't really work out as well, and it's never been tried since. So that was in the early 70s when that happened, you know, when communes were a thing, you know, hippies were still alive and still happening. Living in a commune, I think, is a hard thing to sustain for a long time, unless you're very lucky and you have the right people involved.
Right, living off the land and growing your own food is very difficult.
Absolutely, yeah. But it'd be a lovely thing to do. I think more and more I quite fancy doing that. And like not watching the news, you know, it's like it'd just be nice to just kind of go off grid. There's a dream.
You've got some solo projects too, right? Tell me about your solo projects.
Yeah. Well, I've been doing stuff for a while now, on and off. I mean, I've only got around to releasing one solo album, which is Dreams and Absurdities, which is was released on the Esoteric label, which is a sub-label of Cherry Red. I think, well, every member of the band, we all have other projects. We all do other stuff. And I'm currently working on my second solo album, but I've also more recently released an album with my Norwegian trio. I lived in Norway for 5 years and put together a trio there which is kind of all improvised. Although if you listen to the album that we released last year, it's not what you would think of as improvised music, really. Very melodic and kind of groovy and atmospheric and it's worked out really well. I mean, we just kind of get together and play without any preparation beforehand, which makes live concerts kind of scary. But it always works out. It's amazing. I say Norwegian. There aren't any actual Norwegians in the band. The other two guys live there, still live in Norway. There's a guy called Roy Powell, keyboard player, who's much more of a jazz player than anybody else I work with. But he's an incredible player, and he's played with a lot of the jazz greats. And the drummer is American, actually. He's from Boston. He's called Ted Parsons. He played with Prong and Swans and a lot of those kind of post-rock things, Godflesh. He's probably the most famous member of the trio, but he's a great groove player, really solid. And anyway, I'm working on the second album with them. And I'm also working on I'm mixing some live tracks that I did with Theo Travis, the previously mentioned sax player, and Bill Nelson, whose band Bebop Deluxe were pretty big in the US and around in the 70s.
Oh yeah, I remember Bebop Deluxe.
Bill's an incredibly influential guitarist, like, as is Steve Hillage. I'm kind of lucky to play with some amazing guitarists. And anyway, yeah, we used to play. Bill Nelson had a convention every year that we played at, and we were a trio called Orchestra Futura. So I'm currently mixing some of those live tracks for a possible release later this year, which is one to look out for.
How were you endorsed by David Allen? What's the story there? How did that go down?
Yeah, well, obviously, I joined in 2009. So I played with David for like 5 years before he had to leave. So when I joined, it was with David and Jilly and Steve Hillage and Maquette. They were all in the band at the time. So I was already a member. And Ian East, the sax player, joined 6 months after me. So the two of us had played with Gong for a long, long time. Steve Hillage and Maquette left after a couple of years, and then we did a tour, and then Fabio Golfetti, who's our current guitarist, he came in 2012, and then Carvis Tarabi joined a couple of years after that. So we kind of gradually came into the band over several years, and as I say, when David realized he couldn't carry on with it, he asked us to, well, he, you know, he was very keen for Gong to continue, so we got in Cheb Nettles on drums because Orlando was David's son, who was previously playing drums at that time, you know, was living in Australia, so we needed an English drummer. So That's how it all came together, but David was obviously instrumental in putting this lineup together, but he was really loved what we were doing. He was really he heard the tracks. Obviously, we worked together on the ICU, and he was really enjoying new tracks that we were working on. We played with Steve Hillage and Maquette. You know, quite recently we've been playing as a unit, playing the Steve Hillage Band material around Europe, which has been great. And Steve's a massive supporter of us. He thinks we're fantastic. So he's really positive. And you know, as all the others, Mike Howlett, bass player before me, you know, guested with us when we at one of the concerts that we played. And he's been very supportive. Didier Malherbe plays on a couple of the our early albums that we did with this lineup, and he, you know, he's very keen. He was hoping to guest with us when we played in Paris last year, but he wasn't.
And there's still your signature glissando guitar, right? Do you think Jimmy Page got that idea from you? Got the idea of using the bowstring live from you guys?
I wouldn't say that. I don't know, really. Maybe he tried to recreate the sound without knowing how it was done. I mean, I think that glissando idea originally came from Sid Barrett. I think he did it initially, and David saw Sid Barrett doing it, and then he took it on. But I think he improved the technique, the way he plays, and then Steve Hillage learnt it from David and improved it again. And now Steve Hillage thinks Fabio Golfetti, who's the guy who does it in the current lineup, is the greatest glissando guitar player. Fabio's done some YouTube videos demonstrating how he does it, as has Steve Hillage, actually. So you should check those out. So, but it is a signature part of the sound, that along with the sax. You know, if you have those two elements, you're going to sound like Gong, I think. So yeah, we've carried on in that. I mean, that's probably the only, those aspects of the sound of Gong are the only things that we try to include in whatever we do, I suppose.
And you don't have a female singer, the other signature of Gong.
Well, that's true. Well, to a certain extent, yeah, that's true. But Jilly, this kind of space whisperer thing. The thing is, we're not a tribute band. We're not trying to sound like early Gong. And if David was still in the band, he would absolutely not want us to sound like that.
Right.
So,
right.
It's never been a consideration that we have to try and do what came before. You know, you often see comments on Facebook and stuff about people saying, oh yeah, but you don't have, you should have a keyboards in the band, you know. But Gong didn't always have keyboards. There was a keyboard Tim Blake played in the, I think, two or three of the, yeah, in the trilogy that was recorded in the 70s.
And the keyboards were more for ambient atmospheric sound, right? That you can do that with the instruments that you have.
And we get, if you come see one of our shows now, you are going to be, totally knocked out by the atmospheres that are created with the instruments that we're playing, you know. I mean, Carvis Tarabi's, astonishing guitarist in his own way, and a totally unique player, and he gets some astounding sounds. And I use Ebow on the fretless bass, which not many people have tried, and that's a very distinctive sound as well. So it kind of gives a whole new, this is a new Gong. This is, it's a continuation of what came before, but it's not in any way harking back to what came before.
And the sounds kind of fly around the room like they used to?
You mean like using like a quad sound system or something?
What about the show itself? You have an amazing light show, right?
Yeah, we have projections and the lighting's very important. So yeah, we give, it's much more than just a band that plays one song after another. The whole set is a journey. It's a total experience in so many ways. When you could say it's a trip, but you don't need to take any other substances to experience the wonder and the majesty and the mysticism. It's a total experience. And
if you're not high when you show up, you probably will be by the time you leave.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. It's one thing listening to records or watching videos, but when you experience the thing live, it's an absolutely other world, I tell you.
A couple of questions about the bass. You're playing fretless?
Yeah, I always play fretless bass.
Oh, so we're going to see that?
Totally.
That's fantastic.
When I joined, I auditioned for Gong when I joined, and I auditioned playing a Fender Precision because that's what Mike Howlett played, the guy before me. And I assumed that would be the sound that they wanted. But I also brought along my fretless my Vigier, a French made fretless bass. And they totally loved it. So, and they insisted that I play that. So I've always played fretless bass.
I'm a big fan of Gary Willis. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Oh yeah, Gary Willis. Yeah.
I remember seeing Mick Karn playing in David Torn, interpreting what Tony Levin did on the Chapman stick.
So, okay.
Anything about the sound of the fretless bass?
Yeah, well, I find the fretless bass, it's a part of me now. It's a total, you can be so expressive on the fretless bass in every way. It really is an amazing instrument. I mean, obviously, Jaco Pastorius would be considered the world's greatest, and the, not the originator, but he's the one who totally made it his own thing. But he played in a way that was his character. You know, there's no point in trying to copy what he did, because no bass player is Jaco Pastorius, because he didn't really play bass lines. You know, he played what came into his head. I mean, there were other players who took it on who I preferred. John Giblin was an Irish bass player who played with Peter Gabriel and Kate Bush and Brandex, and an incredible player. And he played, he had all the technique, and yet, but played as he was a supportive musician, you know, which is what a bass player, you know, 90% of the time is what we're there to do.
You're the one that's keeping time and linking everyone together, right?
Well, it's linking together is the crucial thing. Yeah. I consider that to be my job in this band. And when we've got a drummer who's got to be one of the greatest drummers in the world, who is not, you know, he isn't recognized as yet for some reason, but he is an astounding drummer. And there's every member of the band has got a very distinctive sound. My job is a lot of the time finding the link that holds it all together. But equally, you know, I'm not a player who plays root notes, you know, all the way through the set. I mean, I have freedom to do what I want.
I notice it's the notes between the notes that I'm always watching for. You're keeping the beat, but it's the stuff you do in between laying down the beat that's fantastic, that I'm always watching for.
That's interesting, actually. Yeah, somebody else mentioned that recently. He was talking to Carvis, actually, and he was saying, yeah, he mentioned exactly that. He said, the thing about the way Dave plays is, it's obviously it's the notes, but it's the way he leads up to every note that makes this, why it sounds so distinctive. And it's interesting, I'd never considered that.
Are you guys playing in different time signatures? I know Bruford used to play in 5-4 and things like that, and then you'd meet each other at the end of the bar or measure. Are you guys doing stuff like that?
He played, you know, well, he played in gong, you know, for a few tours. He never recorded there. The songs are constructed in, and often it's the case where some of us will be playing in one time signature while others are playing in a different time signature, and it'll all meet up at a certain point. So, yeah, there's a lot of that going on. There's a lot of intricate rhythmical stuff happening.
Well, so are they more dependent on you than the drummer? I mean, it's the cymbals keep time in rock and roll, right? And the hi-hat keeps time in jazz. Who's keeping time in the band? Right, who keeps it all together?
Well, that isn't the way it works. Everything, every part slots together, but there isn't one thing that's kind of keeping 4-4 or something all the way through. That isn't the way it works. The way we write the material is all together in the rehearsal studio. So we kind of work on stuff and repeating things constantly for days and days on end. So, you know, it gets to a point where you don't have to count. You just know how it slots together.
Wow.
So it's just a case of, and it's not, and it isn't like we sit down and work it all out mathematically. It's often just that we'll be in 15/8 or something, and but that can be broken down into different ways, you know. So, and most of the time it's Cherb the drummer who, his mind is working on so many different levels that he will suggest to one or other member of the band, you know, can you play with this part of the drum kit or something, you know. So obviously a lot of the time I'll be checking out what the kick drum's doing, but it's not always that. It varies at different times, or I'll come up with a different idea. So at one point I'll be playing with the kick drum, and then I'll come in with a dotted rhythm over the top of that, you know. So I'm playing a musical part that's in a dotted rhythm over the basic groove part. So there's all sorts of stuff going on, and it does require everyone. When we're in a section like that, everyone's got to be totally listening and on it, because everyone depends on everybody else.
Kind of meditative though, right? You can't think of anything else when you're doing that.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's fascinating, you know, afterwards talking to people and you know, the real kind of, you know, guys who are wired up in a certain way, they're trying to count what we're doing, and it's like, really.
Yeah, to what do you attribute that? Do you have to learn that, or does some people just have an innate ability to do that?
I think it's absolutely innate with Cherb and with Carvis. That's absolutely the way they've always thought. Carvis thinks a lot in riffs, and usually in very odd time signatures. And that, you know, so the two of them together, that's where they start, you know. The rest of us, I think, have learnt to understand how that works, and you know, and so we've learnt how to do it. But for them, it's totally innate.
So David Allen was sort of political, and Steve Hillage, all his songs are about love and Eastern spirituality and philosophy. And what about politics? I notice you don't have any plans to play Israel.
No, we're not. And although we did once, soon after I joined, we did two gigs in Tel Aviv. But the only reason we did that was because Steve Hillage had been playing with Arabic musicians, and he was very comfortable with us going over and doing those two gigs.
Right, it's the center of human culture over there.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah. And also the people, the vast majority of people there, well, everyone we came into contact with, was just, you know, they just want to live their lives, you know, they just want a peaceful life, and they just want to enjoy music and enjoy life, you know, as every human does on this planet that's wired up correctly. And it's just, you know, it's a horrendous situation that the world is in at the moment. But we don't get involved, you know, lyrically and musically. Well, you know, we're the escape from the world, I think, rather than trying to. I think David Allen probably did believe that music, it came from that era where people thought that music could possibly change the world. I think we can change people's perceptions, but, you know, to try and focus on a particular issue isn't what we're about now. and lyrically, Carvis writes the lyrics, and you know, he writes from his own experiences, and I think he's a very gifted lyricist. If you read the lyrics, he's incredibly gifted the way he uses words. It's not always obvious what he's writing, but it's that people get a lot out of the poetry that's in there. So I think it's, as far as we're concerned, it's better to focus on taking people on a journey rather than, you know, what's going on in the world.
Right, a little bit of escape from life for a while. Although you play You Can't Kill Me, I notice.
That still does come in, yeah, but because it's just such a influential track for Gong. And Master Builder as well is the other one that I've played at every single gig that I've ever done with Gong since 2009, so, you know, 16 years. But I mean, we do that our own way, but it's such an incredible piece. The Steve Hillage wrote that riff, and it's just got to be one of the greatest guitar riffs ever written.
Right, and it has a great bass line too. So I just wanted to touch on this. I'm glad you're doing well, because I thought, you know, I noticed Steve Hackett is, the fans talked him into playing a lot of his old stuff, and he's doing mostly old stuff, and then he adds a few new songs. Luckily, you're able to support yourself with your new material.
He does new stuff as well, yes, but people go to see him to playing the old stuff. And they do it really well, you know. I think that's good luck to him. I mean, he's such a lovely guy. I mean, one of the joys for me about doing this band is that I've ended up hanging out with some of the heroes from the early 70s, people I absolutely, you know, adored. And I'm sort of astounded that now I can meet them at breakfast and just chat about life and stuff. And yeah, he's Steve Hackett, so such a lovely, sweet guy. And I'm really pleased that it's working out for them. But yeah, it wouldn't work for us. I mean, it just absolutely wouldn't work for us. He focuses on the tracks that he was involved in writing with Genesis, and they were absolutely stunningly good. One of my favourite bands of all time. But if we were to try and do the old Gong material, it would kind of come across as bogus, unless there was a way of us rejuvenating it in some way and putting our own stamp on it, which is what we do with Master Builder and Can't Kill Me. But, you know, we've got four albums now of new material. And also, the other thing that was really noticeable in America, which surprised me when we played in the US last, was that nobody said, "I wish you were playing more old stuff." You know, everyone who saw the gig was totally on board. So,
And that's what David Allen would have wanted, also.
It absolutely is. You know, absolutely. He didn't want a tribute band. Yeah, that's not what he's about. I mean, there's a huge hole for someone to go out there and play that old material, you know. They could do it with our blessing. That's great if somebody wants to do that. But we're five composers, five, you know, unique musicians, I think. And we do what we do. So, and it seems to work out.
All right, Dave Stewart, bass player of Gong. Thanks for your time and patience.
Nice to chat with you, Curtis. It's been great.
Thank you.
Nice one.